Good morning. I want to preview before I jump into today's thought. We'll do a series the rest of the summer starting next week. I had lunch with a buddy about a year ago, and we're talking about a strange story from the Old Testament. And he said, you know, it sounds like it's an episode of The Twilight Zone. And I said, that'd be a good sermon series. So I wrote it on a napkin at the restaurant and brought it with me and found it and thought, well, we can do that this summer. So starting next week, just some of the stranger miracles or stories that you're not familiar with. And we'll do one a week as we work our way through the summer. So next week, we'll start with The Twilight Zone. But for today, I knew we would be all about the kids today, and I want to talk to them and to you and give you a challenge here today. I still remember standing outside the campus of Cincinnati Bible College and Seminary. My parents were there. I was about to graduate. My mom was really proud. I had my cap and gown on, and she wanted to take a picture of me and my dad. And she said, now make it look natural, Mark. Put your arm around your dad's shoulder. And my dad said, I still remember, if you want it to look natural, why not have him put his hand in my pocket? Can I get an amen from you dads? One boy graduated from high school and from college, sent home a letter home to his dad. It read, Dear Dad, the university is great. I'm making lots of friends. I simply can't think of anything I need, so if you would like, just send me a card, as I would love to hear from you, your son. Well, he got a reply back from his dad. Dear son, I know that astronomy, economics, and oceanography are enough to keep even an honor student busy. Do not forget the pursuit of knowledge. It is a noble task, and you can never study enough, love, Dad. One college kid made it simpler than that. He wrote home and wrote, Dear Dad, no mun, no fun, your son. And his dad replied pretty simply, Dear son, too bad, so sad, your dad. Not everybody goes to college. My cousin from Hazard went straight to working for Kentucky Fried Chicken after graduating, and if you were to ask him why, even today, he'd tell you it was on his bucket list. I'll wait for you. There's a couple of passages that I really, really like that tie together to me, and I want to do that this morning. But let me talk to you for a moment about Generation Z. Do you know who Generation Z is? You just saw a bunch of them. Those born between 1995 and 2015, they are between 7 and 27 years old. That would be one out of every four Americans, or 80 million people. This generation averages 4 hours a day on their phones. They tell us that 2 out of 3 of this generation is either leaving church or has already left church. Those in this age group are twice as likely as any other generation to become atheist or agnostic. Only 3% of this generation confesses to reading a Bible, leading one prominent religious leader to conclude that no generation before has been as morally and spiritually bankrupt as Generation Z. I read an article he wrote called Spiritually Broke, and my ADD kicked in, and it reminded me of one of my favorite kid videos about being broke, so I want you to check it out before we continue on.
Aiden has $1 bill, 1 quarter, and 2 pennies. How much money does he have? Jayden broke.
How much money? He broke. Well, we're all broke, spiritually speaking. So reading the article, I thought, daggone it, that's depressing. And I don't want to just stand on the soapbox and recite depressing statistics. I'm more of an opportunist. So where some people see a problem, I generally can see something good. So I want to challenge you today, because the truth is our kids and our families need us to fight for them, right? Aren't they worth fighting for, church? They need us to fight for them. Every mass movement started with someone, just one. And when I think about this generation and these kids up on the stage, with all the negativity surrounding them, I can't help but be excited that some young man or young woman from our church will be out there beginning something new, something good, something godly. And I want us to consider these graduates and our young people, and then I want to talk to all of you. But let me start with a passage from Nehemiah. It's a cool passage. Nehemiah is not the last book of the Old Testament, but chronologically it is. So it's the last story in history before Jesus in the New Testament. Israel was taken captivity into Babylon. You're familiar with some of that. Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king. And much like Daniel with the king he served, Nehemiah got in good with the king. King loved Nehemiah. So Nehemiah asked him one day for a favor. And the king said, sure, what is it? And Nehemiah said, I want to go home. I want to rebuild my country. So the king allowed him to go back and rebuild. And we pick it up in Nehemiah 4. Check out this verse. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your homes. Fight for your family, your sons, your daughters, grandchildren, your homes. Too easy to be defeated and depressed by cultural shifts and all the goofiness that goes on and all the news that we see and all the cultural changes. Our families are too precious and too important to simply lose because we refuse to fight for them. They deserve more effort from the church. They deserve more care from the church. They deserve more teaching and encouragement. They are worth fighting for. Amen? Fight for your family. And then Timothy, Paul writes to Timothy and talks about this very thing when he says, I'm reminded of your sincere faith, which first lived in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded now lives in you also. Three generations of faith. Now here's what generally happens, and I'm speaking generally with three generations. What one generation firmly believes, the second generation casually assumes, and by the third generation they adamantly deny it. Look back in history, and that's the trend. What one generation firmly believes, the second generation casually assumes, the third generation adamantly denies. And so what is it that we firmly believed that our grandchildren are going to struggle with? Marriage? Gender? Morality? Ethics? Subjective truth, human life. There's a root cause, and I think I know what it is. Others thought they knew too. Famous author Aldous Huxley wrote over 50 books. He's quite a novelist. He wrote a book called Brave New World that was published in 1932. He predicted that mankind would self-implode because of the pursuit of human pleasure. He had an intern who was more famous than him, named George Orwell, who 17 years later wrote a famous novel called 1984, and his prediction was that the United States would implode because of the pursuit of power. Well, and then I read my favorite author, Clive Staples Lewis, who even took a shot at this in his novel entitled The Hideous Strength, where he predicted that the pursuit of perfection would be our downfall. And if you read each of these novels and watch the current news of the day, it'll make your skin crawl how accurate these authors were, each one describing part of the problem that exists today. But with all due respect to these great authors, I'm a preacher, and my book is the Bible. So I think the Bible puts its finger on it in 2 Timothy 4:3 when Paul says, for a time is coming when people will no longer listen to sound and wholesome teaching. Are we not there? Living in that time, they will follow their own evil desires and will look for teachers who will tell them whatever their itching ears want to hear. They will reject the truth and chase after myths. How long does it take you to find somebody who will tell you what you want to hear? I guess as fast as you can Google, you can find somebody that's going to confirm whatever it is you believe, no matter how goofy it is. I mean, if you want to believe the earth is flat, you can find somebody who will agree with you and tell you what you want to hear. If you want to believe that Diet Coke will kill you, you can find somebody. If you want to believe that Elvis is alive and Chinese restaurants really serve food, you can find somebody. and the Boilers are better than the Hoosiers. You can find somebody who'll tell you, confirm what it is you already believe. Everyone has their own set of custom-made facts, custom-made worldview, and everyone has found someone to tell them what it is they already want to hear. Doesn't take a rocket scientist or a famous author to uncover the reason for this. The ground underneath our feet is shaking and shifting because of the rejection of capital T, truth. How am I supposed to have a conversation with someone who doesn't even believe there's absolute truth? Well, what can we do to fight for our families, for our kids? Well, we can do three things. We can participate, we can pray, and we prioritize. And I'll hit them quickly, I promise. I came out of Walmart the other day and lost my car. So frustrating. It ain't like I went in and did business at the bank and, you know, was in there a long time. I mean, I went in and out and thought, where is my car? This is not a good sign. I came out the west end, but I had parked in the grocery end, and I totally forgot. And I'm like, somebody stole my car. Well, no. Finally, I thought, retrace your steps. Okay, you pulled in by Wings and Rings, and I'm like in the front row way at the other end of the parking lot. So I found my car. But it reminded me of my buddy Ken, who did the same thing, came out of an office building one day in Cincinnati, and he knew exactly where he parked, though. He didn't forget, and his car was gone. And his wife warned him this was going to happen because he always left his key in his car. And it ain't like he lived out in the country. He lived just on the edge of Cincinnati, and she told him all the time, you're just inviting somebody to steal your car. Well, he came out of the office, and his car wasn't there. So he picked up the phone, and he called the police. That was the first call. The second call was the hard one because he had to call his wife and tell her, you were right. He'd rather talk to the police than his wife and tell her she was right. So he called her, said, honey, all those times you told me not to leave my keys in the car, you were right. Somebody stole my car. Well, there was an awkward pause, and then kid said, Donna, are you there? And her exact response was, hey, dork, I dropped you off. He said, can you come and get me? She said, I'll be there in about a half an hour. He said, why is it going to take so long? She said, because I have to convince this policeman I didn't steal your car. You know, when I look back on my life spiritually, like from a kid till now, my grandparents, my teachers, my preachers, my parents, somebody has always dropped me off every step of the way. I would have never gotten to where I'm at with my knowledge of the Bible and my love for the Lord and my work in His kingdom had people not carried me along, brought me to where I need to be. And that's the first thought here. You need to participate in the development of the younger generation. You say, well, how can I do that? Well, you can be an example, first of all. Paul told Timothy, but as for you, continue in what you have learned and have become convinced of, because you know those from whom you learned it. The power of example. You can also be available to them. The psalmist wrote in Psalm 90:12, teach us to number our days and recognize how few they are. Help us to spend them as we should. I'm so thankful for the people that helped Derek and Darcy in the development of our young people. People who are taking their time and giving effort and paying attention, making themselves available to help our kids know Jesus better. We can be an example. We can be available. Let me say this. We need to be positive about them. We speak in generalities so often. You hear people talking about kids today, and rarely is it positive. Of course, there are different dynamics today than when we were young, but if you'll look a little closer for some positive things in our young people, you'll find them. We have so many little ones in Darcy's ministry that are being taught the stories of the Bible, and I meet adults today that didn't grow up in church, and they have no idea about Jonah or Noah, some of the biggies, and our kids are learning about the minor prophets and some of those stories, and I'm really thankful, and I enjoy talking to kids about the Bible. They don't always have their facts right. I've got some answers kids gave in regards to Bible questions and different things, and I've kept this through the years. Like one little boy said, Joshua led the Hebrews in the Battle of Jericho. I could get Jericho and Jericho mixed up. I get that. How about this? The seventh commandment is thou shalt not admit adultery. Makes a big difference if you change one word, doesn't it? Is Will here? Will's here. You like this one, Will. Moses died before he ever reached Texas. Guess that's the promised land to some people. Noah's wife was called Joan. Joan of Arc. The golden rule, Jesus said, is to do one to others before they do one to you. Jesus was born because Mary had an immaculate contraption. They don't make those. Solomon had 300 wives and 700 combines. Guess he was a farmer. One teacher was telling how Lot's wife looked back and turned into a pillar of salt. Little Billy said, my mommy looked back once when she was driving, turned into a telephone pole. But my favorite came from a little boy named Freddie. My favorites always come from boys named Freddie. I don't know why, but he was 6 years old. He said a Christian should only have one spouse, and this is called monotony. I'm glad that our kids are learning. They may not always have the facts straight, but they're learning, and I'm so thankful for the people who are teaching them. We have teenagers and college-age kids in Derek's ministry who are being shaped into godly men and women who want to serve and grow. And I'll say this to all who will hear my voice, and I've been consistent from the get-go. If you ever complain about kids at church and how there are too many and they're too noisy and they're too messy and they're too costly and they're too in the way, then you could visit any number of churches in a 10-mile radius here and never have that problem. I'd rather be where the noise is. Right? Rather be where the noise is. But if you're going to visit those churches, you better visit them soon. Because without noisy kids, those doors won't stay open forever. Through the years, I've refused to join the chorus of complainers about kids at church. I purposely tried to catch kids being good. That wasn't hard around here, and it wasn't to prepare for this message. It's just something that I like to do. We were having WNA worship here in the new worship center, and all the kids were here, and there was a teenage gal over here to the left by herself. And I watched Grace Miller, as we're singing, leave her chair, walk over, talk to her, put her arm around her, lead her back over so that she was a part of the group. And I've seen her do many things like that before. I watched Luke, who just sang for us. He probably won't even remember this because it's probably something he does more often than what I saw. I saw him open a door for one of our elderly ladies who wasn't even near the door yet, but he saw her coming down the hallway, and he waited, held the door, let her go through, and then he went on his way. And I'm sure he's done that before. All the young people who are stepping up and leading in specific areas of ministry, I'm excited about Caleb Fields. Caleb Fields in Turkey, learning the language. Right. I mean, I'm with you. Well, I was talking to his dad yesterday. A couple years ago, we'd be like, no, I had two thoughts for Caleb, jail or Jesus. I'm glad he chose Jesus. But it's amazing what he's doing, and that's because of what has been given to him by his parents and by Derek and by those who have worked with our kids. And maybe if we didn't moan and groan all the time about how bad this generation of young people is, and we started encouraging them and catching them being good and catching them being godly, then we could have more of a positive effect on them. That's what I believe. We can fight for them by participating in their development. We can fight for them by praying for them. This generation has been subjected to a brand of moral confusion unlike any generation in the history of our planet. To put it bluntly, this generation, you kids, are up against it. And we need to pray for them like we've never prayed before. I know it's an uphill battle, but it's something that we can do to fight for our families. I watched a replay of the Super Bowl the other day. I've watched it about five times now. The Bengals lose every time I watch it. I keep hoping for a different result. But the way my mind, I don't sleep very much, and so when I'm laying in bed and I'm thinking about things and spiritual things sometimes, sometimes I play a round of golf in my head if I'm going to a certain course, or I replay a round that I played somewhere, stuff like that. But I'm thinking about the Super Bowl and God and those in heaven watching it from their perch. And I know God probably doesn't care about Super Bowls, but imagine what viewing it from heaven, how different that would be than viewing it from here. So when you see that impressive scene on this little blue dot called Earth, imagine you're surrounded by incomparable heavenly glory. And when you see those 80,000 people in that $5 billion stadium that covers 3.1 million square feet, imagine viewing from the expanse of heaven, surrounded by the millions of redeemed from every tribe and tongue and nation. And when you see those jets fly over the stadium, imagine being encompassed by myriads of angelic beings. And when you watch Snoop Dogg and the rest of those people who need to pull their pants up, do their thing on stage. And when you see the American flag unfurl, hear the national anthem, imagine being surrounded by every believer who has ever lived expressing their allegiance to an eternal king. And when you see the wealth and the excess on display, imagine the value and indescribable riches of heaven. And when you see all the commercials that tell you everything you need to own to be happy, remember you're with the God who makes those things seem irrelevant. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't watch the Super Bowl. I've watched every Super Bowl, even the ones that happened before I was here, and I will watch them all. What I'm saying is a perspective from heaven has to be vastly different than our vantage point here. So when we pray, we are praying from here. This is all I can see, really. But God Almighty, from His perch, His view of things is completely different. We are praying to a God that not only has the power to do what we ask, but has the vantage point to see what we need. We need to pray for our family. I found a verse in Revelation that I love. It almost sounds like Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Terminator, might say it. Revelation 2:13, I know where you live. But it's not a scary, I know where you live. It's a, I know what you're going through. I know what you're up against. I know how hard it is, and I can see it. We're going to fight for our families, our kids. We need to participate in their development and pray for them. And I'm going to close with this third thought, and you probably will wish I closed sooner. We need to prioritize church for our families. Way more important than we realize. And I will not back down from this because I've got scriptural backing, Hebrews 10:23. Let us hold tightly without wavering to the hope we affirm, for God can be trusted to keep His promise. Let us think of ways to motivate one another to acts of love and good works, and let us not neglect our meeting together as some people do, but encourage one another, especially now that the day of His return is drawing near. This applies to our graduates going off to college. It applies to you and me. Fundamentally speaking, the Hebrew writer highlights how important it is for us to be together. Now listen to me. Our kids need us to bring them to church. You can't debate that. Our kids need us to bring them to church. They need the consistency, the discipline, the strength that comes from being here. And I'm not talking about watching a sermon on TV. Now, I'm grateful for online streaming and the influence that has had. I mean, that has been so good for the church. I'm thinking about Larry and Francis this morning. They live toward Mitchell. They're watching. Hi, Larry. Hi, Francis. She's suffering with ALS and getting worse every week. And when they weren't able to go to their church anymore, they found us on TV. They get dressed up on Sunday and sit in front of their TV and worship with us every week. And I'm thankful for that. I know not everyone can get to church, so it's a wonderful service we provide. But, let me talk straight to you this morning. If you can be here, but you're choosing to stream, that ain't why we're doing that. Streaming service was never meant to be a replacement for the kind of fellowship the church provides. You don't just need to watch a 30-minute sermon. You need a hug in the foyer. You can't get that in your living room. You need more than that. If you're discouraged, watching us sing on your TV at home, even singing with us, won't lift you out of the valley. But interacting with other believers who have been discouraged and they're there to encourage you, that'll do it. If I thought by streaming these services we were teaching our kids to just stay home and watch it on TV, I'd take down the streaming today. Immediately. It was never meant to be a replacement for the kind of fellowship and worship and spirit that we get. So I'm calling right now on all bathrobe Christians to come back to church. Get out of your pajamas. Put the fuzzy slippers away. Put the Captain Crunch back on the shelf. It'll tear the roof of your mouth off anyway. Never meant to be a replacement. We need to reprioritize our relationship with the church. Kind of hurts my heart to see kids go off to college and drift away from the church, but I don't have to look far to realize that in many cases their parents had already drifted before they went off to college. Being a part of the church should be one of our top priorities. Bible refers to the church as the bride of Christ. Someone told me recently that I can be a good Christian without ever being part of the church. I would suggest the fact that you even make that statement is reflective of a problem. According to the Bible, the church is the bride of Christ. So for you to somehow conclude you want the groom but not his bride, that doesn't fly. Doesn't work that way. You reject the bride. You reject the groom. And Jesus gave us a perfect example in Luke 4:16. Look at this. He went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day he went into the synagogue, as was his custom. It's what he was taught. It's how he was raised. And I know things have changed, but not that long ago, nothing got in the way of church. Not sports, not the beach, not a slight headache, not the weather. We were taught how important it is to be in church. My dad, this was ingrained in me. We didn't take many vacations, but my brother lived in Houston, Texas, and we went there, and I can still remember my dad going through the Yellow Pages on Saturday night trying to locate a church for us to attend that next morning. And I'll never forget the Sunday morning, it snowed 8 inches. And we live back this lane that's hard to get out of on a good day. 8 inches. And me and my brothers looked out the window, and we're like, praise the Lord. We're going to skip church today. Nope, here comes Logan knocking on the door. You boys ready for church? Well, we're still going to church. Well, why wouldn't we? Is it Sunday morning? We're going to church. Get ready. We get in the car, trudge our way to the car. I mean, 8 inches of snow where we lived is pretty significant. And my mom is letting him have it the whole way to the car. Nothing gets you ready for church like a family argument. She's, well, this is silly. This is silly. Well, we won't even get out the lane. Well, this is silly. She just kept saying it over and over. So he puts us in the car. Our lane's about a mile before you get to the main road, which is 129. And we got half a mile, and we got stuck. And my mom, you have never heard anybody say, I told you so, as many times as she told him. And me and my older brother, we're high-fiving, and we're like, you know what? We get home, we're going to go. We've just put up a new hoop in the hayloft in the barn. Moved all the hay, had a little court. We're going to play basketball on Sunday morning. This is going to be cool. And we're talking out loud, which was our first mistake. We get home, and my dad, we get out of the car. He got us unstuck. And he says, I want everybody to come into the piano room. We had a room with an old piano in it that I would bang on, and we called it the piano room. So we all go in there, and we're like, what is going on? He's like, Mark, play us some hymns. Okay, what? We're going to sing? What? Yeah, we're going to. Is it Sunday morning? Told me what to play. I played it. I'm thinking, okay, my dad, he's against substitutes for communion. He is. He's hardcore with some of this stuff. Now, I'm not quite there, but he doesn't like using regular crackers or some other kind of juice. Well, he had stolen some communion from church. The real stuff. For a moment, just like this. I guess it's a forgivable sin. I don't know. So we have communion. It's just me and my brothers and my mom and dad. And then I see him grab his big Bible that's on his desk. Oh, no. Please. He opens it and he starts preaching and he's pacing in front of us. Preaching a sermon like the whole church is sitting in our room. And his subject is how people today aren't spiritual enough because they'll let things keep them from going to church, like the weather. And then he specifically pauses and says, and boys who were raised better want to play basketball instead of go to church. You can't get away from preaching like that. When you all could sneak out the door or hide behind a neighbor, we couldn't go anywhere. And you would think, with it being a small audience and people he knew really well, that the sermon would be cut short. Ha! I think to spite us, he went even longer. Let me have it. I'm telling you, if it wasn't our own house, I would have walked the aisle and been rebaptized on the spot. Not everybody's raised like that. I understand that. But I'll say this. Let me ask you a question, because I think I know every single one of you what the answer would be. What chances, spiritually speaking, do our children have without the church? Right? They don't have a chance. They just don't have a chance. They need us to fight for them, to participate in their development, to pray for their well-being and spiritual lives, to prioritize church and how important it is. Joshua told the people one day that they needed to make a choice. He said, choose this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Found a picture of Elsie Rogers, a mother back in Civil War days. She already sent her sons off to fight and her grandsons. When the soldiers came to her house, she met them on the porch with a shotgun, double-barrel 12-gauge. They said, are you going to fend off the entire Confederate army with that gun? She said, probably not, but no one will doubt whose side I'm on. Let me ask you, church, our kids, our family, they need us to fight for them, so can we show them in this world whose side we're on? Aren't they worth fighting for? Our families, our homes, our kids, our future, the church need us to fight for them. They need us to fight for them.